Life riddles are answered in the movies.
That's a big twinkie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to GMC Episode 18, the podcast that in Australia is now legally allowed to drink and drive.
Oh, yeah.
I am David McVeigh.
I'm the rambunctious Richard Gray.
I'm David Longo.
And I am calling this issue to order.
Hey, you got yourself a gavel.
I did.
Good Although, for you.
Because I've got the soundboard turned down because of the music, we didn't get to hear it in full score. So I'll play it again later.
Order. In full stereo sound.
Hi, boys. Sound, how are you?
I'm on a high, a creative and emotional high, because we just recorded Behind the Panels episode 100.
We did, and this is what the gavel should have sounded like. There you go.
It sounds so much better.
It does, doesn't it? When we were in Melbourne last week, yes, we missed an episode because we went to Oz Comic Con. Jeffrey, with him, said to me that we really did need a gavel. So it got me off my bike, I have this.
He also mentioned to me that he thought I'd be taller. I sound taller.
Did you go, well, I'm smarter.
No, because I think I do sound a lot taller than I actually am. But
how do you sound tall?
Unless
the quote of the year. How do you sound tall?
The two things I want to say. So I have this rich, fruity, jam-like voice. Because it's rich and fruity, it's jam-like. Mm. Also, I think maybe the reason it's so rich and fruity and down here is because I've got a low center of gravity. I'm closer to the ground, and therefore I sound greater. The other person we need to give a big shout-out to, because we mentioned him over on Behind the Panels, .net, on the Behind the Panels issue 100. Did we mention that we did 100 episodes of that? Is John D. We mentioned him there. He also had cupcakes and tea with us that afternoon and coffee. And he insisted that we tell the story of him being, and we're also going to tell another story a little bit later about David in a car. But he also mentioned the fact that, look, John D., lovely guy, world's worst archer. Because let's face it, he turned up in his Green Arrow gear. When I had breakfast with him that morning, he misplaced his bow.
It was the same place as my car.
Yeah, right. Then he struggled to get his shaft back into his quiver. There's an entendre for you. Later in the day, he coined a new phrase, I think, when he accidentally cut his finger on an arrowhead as he was fishing for something else in his pocket, and he let out without even, he didn't even realize he'd let out the words "son of a cunt." So, which is now my new favorite phrase.
It's good stuff. And he bled like a stuck pig.
And then it refused, like a good superhero, refused any offer of a Band-Aid. Because the first aid tent was far too far away.
Did he go up to the officials and be like, can I have any compensation for this cut? Any compensation for this cut?
He did cut himself on his own arrowhead, I should mention. So there you go, John D., stand-up guy, world's worst archer.
And there is a reason why you're not allowed to take weapons into Supernova.
Yes. You could there is a photo of that he's got on his Facebook page where he's like pointing his arrow straight at the cameraman. That cameraman is braver than I am. I took my photos from a safe distance.
Yeah.
So if you're going in there with the fake swords, the fake axes, do you need to get approval?
You're not allowed to take in things over a certain size, yet they sell the swords in the venue, so go figure.
Those rules don't seem to apply to Oz Comic Con. Supernova... Literally.
No, they do. There was a little man checking at the door.
Oh, was it? Because literally Supernova...
He wasn't that little.
All these people showing up in their cosplay with their great big, you know, Final Fantasy swords, which are obviously not real weapons.
Yeah.
Because they're these big over-exaggerated things. But they were being removed from people. Basically saying you couldn't take anything. Oz Comic Con's a little bit more liberal than that.
Well, let's mention very quickly, Oz Comic Con was great. I went to the Game of Thrones panel while we were down there. That was wonderful to see that. Go and listen to... I also went to the Gestalt publishing panel. Full story of that over at Behind the Panels. But I got to mention, because I mentioned this story quickly on panels, which was I ended up in a lift, an elevator for those in America, with Tom Taylor, who we interviewed for Behind the Panels. And he shakes the hand of the guy standing behind me, turns around. It's a huge 7-foot-something guy. It's bloody Hodor. I'm in a fucking lift with Hodor. And
for those who don't watch the series, that's from Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. And that was amazing because...
Is there anybody who doesn't watch Game of Thrones?
Yeah, I know of a couple of listeners, in fact, who don't watch anything. Okay. Game of Thrones. Don't like fantasy.
They don't watch anything. Huh?
Don't watch anything. they're actually blind. So it's unfortunate, but that's a good thing. We're an audio show. either by their own design, because they've just been drinking a lot, or that... Unfortunately, they're blind.
That would be Paul Bedford you're talking about, right?
Well, possibly. Hi, Paul, if you're listening. Hi, Paul. Speaking of stand-up blokes, hi, Paul. So, yeah, I that was the most surreal moment of that weekend.
Can I tell you how proud I was of Paul Bedford, though, when I handed him one of our bumper stickers? And he stuck it on his booth? I thought that was awesome.
That was brilliant. Look, you know, so much fun at Oz Comic Con. We felt so welcome this time. Thank you so much to the Oz Comic Con guys. Go check out behindthepanels.net and, of course, Behind the Panels issue 100 for all the stuff we got out of that con. Such a fun time. We're going to go in September and we're going to bring you along with us, Dave Longo. So
it also made me the brunt of a running joke, which we should probably bring up right now because I'm never
going to... Everybody remember where we parked.
I'm never going to live this down. I had a rental car in Melbourne for the weekend, which I proceed... there's no easy way to say it. I lost it twice. Yeah. Right?
It means the car. It didn't just lose his shit.
No, you know? I lost the car twice. And funnily enough, I lost the car twice when it was parked in the same place, which was even better.
Yeah, we had to take a photo the
Maybe
second time.
Maybe it was like
time,
a Ferris so. Bueller's Day Off situation. Yeah. Maybe someone stole it, returned it.
Did you check the odometer?
to my defense, it was a very neutral gray car that just blended.
It was
with
a rental. It was a rental.
It was a rental,
so,
and
yeah.
I didn't know it.
But it did start a running gag where... We thought that Dave might have been losing it slightly. What we don't want to tell him is that he's already told the story three times on this episode. we just had to edit it out later.
And the ultimate joke to the whole thing was, after losing the car twice, when I returned the car on Monday afternoon, I actually took it to the wrong place.
I did not know that.
It wasn't far off, but it was the wrong car park.
What's that American one? Hertz? Is it Hertz?
It's Hertz. This is budget. This is budget. So I left it at the Avis.
So thank you to the good people at Budget Rent a Car for giving David a car he couldn't find twice.
So it was a fun time. But while we were in Melbourne,
he's driving on the wrong side of the road.
While we were in Melbourne, we also got to see something. So I think we should hit up the what we've been watching.
I'm watching you, Wazowski. Always watching.
Richard and I got to go to the famous Astor Theatre in Melbourne, which
yes,
is
lovely,
which is a treat in itself to go to. It's an old-fashioned decor.
I think it's the only single-screen cinema left in Australia or something like
or
that.
Or left in Melbourne, at least. Possibly, I'm not sure if it's all of Australia, but it is an amazing...
Certainly of its stature. You know.
Absolutely. Amazing
cinema.
Did it
have a piano coming out of the front?
It doesn't, which is one of the one things missing, but the Brighton Dendy does. It actually has an organ.
I think they have one at the Chevelle in Paddington.
There
as well.
You go. Yeah. But the Astor is still all of the original fittings, so the seats are the original fittings.
For better or worse.
For better or worse. And not particularly comfortable, but it's just this amazing feeling. But it's a fully modern equipped cinema. There is actually a digital projector 4K. In there. 4K projector plus the original 35mm projector. And the print we saw of Alien on Friday was the original 35mm
print.
Oh,
boy, was it. Yeah.
And it was gorgeous, scratches and all. And we got a Q&A with Tom Skerritt. Which
80
was
years young.
80 years young, and I think... possibly under the influence of something.
Let's not. Of jet lag.
Let's go. Let's leave it at that. But he was fascinating because he really didn't give a shit about anything, did he?
No. One girl asked if he could touch his moustache at one point. It was funny because he was talking at one point and he goes, did I have the moustache in Top Gun? And the whole audience was like, yes, you did.
I love the fact that he would say things like, you know, somebody would say, which is your favorite film? He goes, I don't care.
Well, no, the thing I loved was when the host had clearly done all this research. And he said, what about the time and blah, 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 blah. And he was like, yeah, we can get to that eventually. And I was like,
well, one of my favorites was when he goes, is it true? And he rattles off all these facts and Tom Skerritt just goes, no.
No. So he's obviously done a lot of internet research in the
lead
up to it.
He clearly wants to keep gigging, doesn't he?
No, it was fabulous. And we got to talk to him. And one of the most interesting things that he actually did say, though, was that he'd never seen the director's cut of Alien, which has his cocoon scene in it. And somebody asked him which one he preferred. And he actually made a really, really valid point, and we really watched for it this time, which was he said, I've never seen the director's cut, but my impression is as a filmmaker, because he also teaches filmmaking, he said he feels it would slow the film down. It would actually destroy the pace of that scene. And interestingly enough, when we watched it this time around, we were specifically looking for that. And he's right. It actually blows the pacing of that scene because there is no reason for Ripley to be there. She actually has to go out of her way to go down a ladder, find the cocoon scene.
I think Tom's downstairs. I'll go visit him.
I think he's downstairs. She goes down. She sees it. She does the flaming. Then she goes back up the ladder. And it's like, why did you? No wonder the scene was cut.
Yeah.
As much fun as it was to see it as a deleted scene, I think reintegrating it into the film was actually a mistake.
Yeah, I agree completely. The only and the other thing that I noticed while watching it with an audience, and we talked about this before a show, was that there's a scene where you find out, look, spoilers for a film that's 30, 40 years old, is, you know,
I think we're past the...
Ash is a goddamn robot.
Full of milky goodness.
Full of milky goodness. Title right there for an episode, I think. So once you find out, and the milky goodness is everywhere, and they put the head down on the table, and there's this really awkward cut when it cuts back to being actually Ian Holm, on the table. All they needed was like a reaction shot to cut off to.
A bridge, yeah.
A bridge, and the whole audience burst into laughter at the 70s-ness of it all, which I thought was a bit weird because there was obviously a few people in the audience who'd never seen the film before.
Well, he actually went out of his way to ask, was there anybody who hadn't seen it?
And there was a handful
of people who had never seen Alien.
In any form whatsoever. So, which
did,
is,
did he talk about the original title of Alien?
He actually says that he'd never saw it as that title.
What was it, Starbased?
No. Wasn't it on Giant Penis Chases Girl?
No. Talk about full of dairy goodness.
David, I've got a brand new episode title.
Yeah, Ridley Scott saw Dan O'Bannon's script and was like, subtext a bit on the nose there.
I think I've seen that film, though, as well, to be honest.
That's the porn parody,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
It was about
a girl in trouble.
The tagline was, this time it doesn't shoot on their chest.
or neck or face. Yeah.
In space, no one can hear you. No.
We've all been face-hugged. Come on.
Let's go so far as to say that it was magnificent to see this film on the big screen again. If you've never seen Alien on the
check
big screen.
Check those corners, sorry.
It is really, really worth having a look at. Yeah, yes,
beautiful.
There's a couple of janky cuts in there, granted, but this film is still, I think, almost a flawless film.
It's an icon of sci-fi. It's an icon of horror.
Yeah.
And really, it's a great actor's sci-fi piece, even though, you know, probably in the script.
Tom Skerritt talked about that.
And yeah, even though probably maybe even the script, you don't think that there's a lot happening there. Every single one of those actors owns their role completely.
So well
takes
defined.
It, takes
well,
it seriously.
Yeah. Everybody is so well
no
defined.
No one's phoning it in.
Harry Dean Stanton and Yaphet Kotto as the two engineers.
Talk about the bone situation.
Are just so good. That sequence still to this day holds up. And the power and the audience laughs.
Yeah.
So you know it works where they're trying to talk to Ripley and the steam is going everywhere
and
she can't hear them and they can't hear her and they're going, yeah, whatever. And she finally walks away and he just turns a dial and the steam stops and the whole audience just bursts into laughter.
But it's early. Set design too.
Set design is brilliant.
You can't really say that a lot of movies revolutionized cinema.
No.
But that one.
Ron Cobb's spaceship was amazing. Giger's Alien and
soundtrack, Goldsmith.
Goldsmith's soundtrack. It is a film, and considering that it is Ridley Scott's second feature film, is an amazing effort.
There are very few films that I can point to and go, that's a perfect film.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect film.
Yeah.
That's right. And it will always be, as much as I love Aliens, we had this discussion a few episodes back. For me, Alien will always be the better film because it's a brilliant film. Aliens is a standout example of an
action film. Yeah.
And it is a perfect action film in a lot of ways as well. One where the extended version is actually better in some ways.
Yes, I agree.
Did you guys hear the Alien Isolation news? You know the
game?
Did you hear about
this? It's about it being the original Alien?
No, about a voice actor that's
come
on. Did you hear about this?
No.
Okay. Sigourney Weaver is reprising Ripley in the
cast.
All
right.
I don't know the context or how, but she's done recording work as Ripley.
It's meant to be the original.
Which is amazing.
It's meant to be the alien from the first film has somehow survived its being blown out of the airlock. Yeah. So,
okay.
And this game, for those of you who don't know, it's a alien video game where there's a single alien.
Right.
And it's hunting you down. And it sounds phenomenal, like Dead Spacey kind of phenomenal. So
fantastic.
Can't wait.
So yes, overall, and the last thing we'll mention about this very quickly is we had the famous Astor Theater Chalk Tops while we were there. No, I've got to tell you.
Did they hand make them there?
Yeah.
They are ice cream to the bottom of the cone, big tall top.
Creamiest, tastiest ice cream.
These are, every cinema should take a page out of the Astor and how to make a Chalk Top.
Yeah, I had the boysenberry.
And I had the vanilla, as always, they are just amazing.
I used to work in a cinema for a long time, and the Chalk Tops that would come in, we'd trash maybe half of them because they're all broken, smashed.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, we got free Chalk Tops at an IMAX screening the other night, and you had to throw it out.
I had to throw it out because it was melted by the time
and,
I got
and
to it.
And broken in half.
It was broken in half, and I tried to reassemble it, and it just poured out the bottom of the bag, and it's like, oh, this is disgusting.
It was a free Chalk Top, to be
sure,
fair,
but so it was disgusting. Yeah.
Next time, throw it into the curtain, because staff cleaners really
IMAX
like that.
IMAX doesn't have curtains.
Yeah.
True, IMAX
doesn't have
curtains. The amount of times we used to have to clean Chalk Tops that were like 7 meters off the ground with ladders.
You know, when you're in cinemas and you thought you had to clean up ice cream? I had to break it to you.
I don't want to work this. Okay, if you really, rule one, I'm pissing off.
Speaking of full of dairy goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, here's what you do. If you really want to piss off a cinema employee that's cleaning the cinema, tip your popcorn on the ground.
Yeah.
And then grind it in with your feet.
Yeah.
Grind it in.
We are not encouraging this behavior in any way, shape, or form. What else did we see, though?
Through the magic of post-production, there'll be a trailer for it right here.
I know why you're scared. It took us 4 years fighting that virus, but we are survivors.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. You can't blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I going to blame?
We need to give them a chance.
Welcome to animals. Please. I've seen things. I've seen the way they are. They want what we want, to survive.
Caesar, home. This is your home. Your home.
Are you aware they are going to turn on you?
They don't want a war.
No! Don't shoot!
Caesar, you have to go.
Strong. War, it's not what you want. There must be another way.
War has already begun.
That's right, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Absolutely.
we didn't have
one prepared.
No, because we spent all of our time preparing the other show.
Let's do the trailer. We'll do an audio version.
No.
I'll provide the soundtrack.
do it as Mark Wahlberg. considering
that through the miracle of post-production we've already put the trailer in, let's not. Let's just talk about this. So this is the sequel to...
See how your mouth wanted.
All right, settle down. So this is... Hang on. Order!
ooh. Me, sir.
I'm going to love this button, can I tell you?
Come on, Richard.
Everybody remember where we parked.
Come on, Richard, settle down. We got a show to record, okay? Come on.
All right, so Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, directed by Matt Reeves.
Yes.
Yes, Matt Reeves.
Yeah. I said that in such a way of like, how do you not know? Yeah.
Matt Reeves, this is the
Cloverfield.
Sequel. Cloverfield and Let Me In.
Let Me In, yeah.
And this is the... He also co-wrote...
Felicity.
No.
It's true, though. If Kerry Russell needs a job, call Matt Reeves.
I was looking him up the other day, and I was really surprised to see that he'd co-written... I'll look it up through that miracle of, you know, interconnected computers that we have.
Yeah. I could do that.
But,
I'll do that now for you.
But he co-wrote a film as well, which I thought was unusual for him. However...
Stuart Little 2.
I think he actually wrote She's All That, didn't he?
However, that being said, this is the sequel to Rise of the Planet Apes that we so highly praised when it came out.
And now it is shit in retrospect.
In retrospect, this film was extraordinary. Dave, tell us what you thought of it.
Like a masterpiece? I was enamored by this movie.
Yeah, I've seen it twice.
Speaking of Stuart Little 2, I just wanted to quickly mention earlier in the week, the real James Woods tweeted out, "Obama is the disaster for all from whom all disasters follow." And Joe Mand tweeted back to him, "You ruined Stuart Little too." And that's been retweeted 700 odd times. So
I'm going to go and retweet that myself.
I'll just give a quick spill, I guess, because I thought the first one was okay. I didn't think it was
too great.
But now in retrospect, goddamn.
Yeah.
Goddamn.
I watched them because I watched it the night before. Yeah. I saw
you look at the differences in this. For me, there's a couple of heroes in this movie. I think the first is like the decision to have the apes be the leads.
Yeah.
You know, and then secondly is that fucking brilliant script.
Yeah.
Like, it's just layered deep. It's amazing. But the hero of this movie for me is Michael Giacchino. That score blew my fucking mind right open.
Still not available to buy.
I've been
looking for it.
There was a moment in the movie where that score like hit me so hard because it's amazing how you go and see sci-fi these days and it's just... And this had like a comedic edge to it almost. Yeah.
I have that film for you. He co-wrote Under Siege 2.
Really?
Yeah. Sorry, Under Siege 2, Dark Territory.
Dark Territory.
But anyway, like all the visual effects work, like that first shot of Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
Not to mention
the final shot.
You lose your bowels.
Yeah, because
speaking of cinema owners having to clean things up.
How amazing is it that those effects are so good that we can get that close?
Yes.
And still absolutely buy that character.
This is the point about the film. I mean, you sort of were alluding to it, Dave, that the fact that it's almost a foreign language film because the first 20-30 minutes of this film
is sign language.
Not a human to be seen, except for the stock footage. Not the stock footage.
And the subtitling is brilliant.
They subtitled basically sign language and apes kind of speaking their first bits of English.
Mm. Can I just stop you quickly?
Yeah.
This is something that was really important to me last night because a friend of mine had commented, he didn't see the first one.
Yeah.
So his comment was like, it's strange how they subtitled the apes. I thought it would have been better if they were left unsubtitled.
Interesting.
And I thought briefly like, well, that's interesting. You know, I had that problem in the first one. I thought the first film, everything that was communicated was, you know, clear as day. Like, it didn't need to be subtitled. Whereas in this one, everything that's being communicated is almost not literally what they're saying.
Yeah.
It's like they're signing, like they're going instinctually and all that stuff, but it's more interpreted for us, the audience, to figure
out
what
they're
saying.
Because they're also speaking whatever ape language it is they're speaking as well. So they're signing, but with their grunts and groans and what have you. So there's obviously more to their signing, because their signing is very simple.
Yes.
But they're conveying a great deal of
information. And that's what these subtitles did, was it conveyed the facts, and the emotion was there on them. And that was just absolutely crazy.
I mean, look, the human actors in this are terrific as well. Just terrific.
Yeah.
So I got a little bit dusty.
Gary Oldman!
Gary Oldman. Look, you know, racist old bastard, Gary Oldman. He's basically a racist old bastard in this film as well. He's sort of anti-ape. But every person in
But they're the sub-characters, you know?
But you know what? There are no perfunctory characters in this. Everybody who's in there serves a purpose. And it's so rare in a blockbuster film that you don't just get the token kid who's coming along, you know, just to so they have someone to save later on. Everyone there has a purpose that plays out throughout the film as well.
This was like perfect filmmaking, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like almost perfect. Because like it has that scene at the beginning where they're in a car and they explain the whole set of the movie.
Yeah.
And when you look at the movie's construction itself, it's amazingly simple, right? It's like the whole setup of the story is like you have humans on one end, you have the apes on the other. That's literally the only two sets of the movie.
Mm. All it needed was like a West Side Story dance sequence.
There is a moment, you know, Matt Reeves, hat off to him, because he created something special to me last night. Like I saw the movie last night, obviously. But for example, Matt Reeves' genius is like, there's a scene where the main character, Malcolm, the human main character, is going to meet with the apes. And he's wearing a poncho with a hat, but it's styled in a way to remind you of like iconic Westerns. And so it takes you into this. It's just like conveyed visually and brilliantly. Like, you know,
that's Jason Clarke playing Malcolm.
Jason Clarke. Yeah. He's an Australian, right? I believe.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He was in probably the most recent things you've seen him in, Zero Dark Thirty, Lawless, and The Great Gatsby.
Second thing, this is like, you might not think about it straight away, but it really affects you, because this is one of the best comments on gun control I've ever seen in my life.
Actually,
And because the whole thing is you have humans that care only about themselves and apes that only care about, you know, themselves too at the beginning. And then guns get involved.
Yep.
And it just becomes this great meditation on what it is to be human, what it is to be in touch with nature, and how guns come in and fuck it all up.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, a statement about...
Then there's the father-son relationships, yeah, and
but
the
it's
family.
Also a massive statement about basically geopolitics as well. Yeah. The whole idea of a belief structure where Caesar is living by the philosophy that apes are better than humans.
Yes.
Apes don't kill apes. Apes will live together
in
peace.
Which is the famous guns don't kill people.
Absolutely.
People
yeah.
kill.
Yeah.
Once we introduce the humans, because of petty belief structures, Koba ends up betraying his people, something that Caesar didn't believe possible.
Mm.
And he betrayed his people, blamed somebody else, and ignited a war, mm-hmm. right? So what you've got is you've got this metaphor for humans and how just because of a belief structure that we work by, that we can completely screw ourselves over because we aren't willing to look at all sides of the equation.
Well, you see, Koba is someone who's seen the worst of humanity.
Mm. Absolutely.
He spent his entire life in labs, and by the time he's introduced in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, he is he's already been tortured and abused, and he's...
And it was actually one of the most brilliant things about Rise of the Planet of the Apes, was you thought Koba was going to be a bad guy.
No.
Because how scarred up he is and how evil he looks, but then he turns out to be this faithful assistant. And it was a beautiful moment.
Koba has some wonderful moments in this film too, where he's pretending to be like a house ape kind of thing. And there's a whole... And as a result of that, there's this whole subtext, certainly in the first one and this one too, there's the notion of slavery and, you know, sort of the way America responds to
that. So that scene with Koba where he's basically saying, humans did this.
Yes.
Humans did this. And he's pointing to all of his scars.
It's like, it doesn't matter what they want to treat us like now, there's a history there.
This is what they did.
You know. Yeah, as you said, the politics as well. Like, you know, like how important influence is, you know, on a society. You know, like, you know, the leader and...
Well, and there's that lovely line where they say,
fear,
they'll
intimidation.
You because they'll know you're alive. And he says, they won't follow me unless I'm strong.
Yeah.
Frankly, it doesn't matter that he's still alive.
Frankly, this is science fiction at its best.
Absolutely.
Like, it's very, very best.
Exactly.
And on top of this, one thing as well is that it never feels... didactic. It never feels like you're getting lectured or you're being preached at.
No, it's an
adventure film first, you know. Yeah. Like, and all
even
this
the original Planet of the Apes kind of were a bit heavy-handed in that sense, where they were like, they blew it up. God damn you all to hell! You knew exactly what they were saying there.
Oh, another thing too, briefly speaking in that, like this movie as well had the restraint not to wink at the originals.
Yes,
which was also refreshing
because in Rise and of the also, Planet of the Apes, they did wink a couple of times.
A few times. This one, when you think about it. Though, say you're a screenwriter in Hollywood and you're given the task to like sequelize Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's like in my mind, like Matt Reeves going, let's set this a few years after, you know, let's set this way. And
but
just
it's
skip
that. 10 years later. So.
Yeah, you know, 10 years later, like that is the first like ballsy move, I think, for
and
a franchise.
And it's the most interesting aspect because it's actually a comic we speak about over at Behind the Panels this week. It's called Spread. And in the back matter of that, the author says, you know what? The apocalyptic story that's always interested me is not those first few days, which we always see on The Walking Dead and Dawn of the Dead and all those kind of things. It's what happens 10, 20 years later. Yeah. How is society dealing with that? And you're right. That's what makes Dawn of the Planet of the Apes
a fascinating
story.
I'm not ashamed to admit it, but I cried several times throughout it.
Oh, man, there was a lump in my throat from about halfway through to the end.
I had tears crying. And there were certain shots I had tears flowing just because of the sheer... Like, I was so impressed by this film. I don't know what it was.
No, it's amazing. I've seen it twice, and it has just as much impact the second time around.
He's a master filmmaker. Like, get him on Star Wars, not these other guys. Like,
look, Matt Reeves, I've said Matt Reeves is actually very talented from way back when I saw Cloverfield. A lot of people didn't like Cloverfield. I really like Cloverfield. And I thought, all right, granted we had the Blair Witch Project before, but let's face it, Cloverfield was the birth, really, the coming of age of found footage films.
Yeah.
And he managed to integrate amazing special effects and all this high-tech stuff into this very low-tech film. And I thought he did an amazing job. I thought Cloverfield was actually a very interesting film to watch.
Totally.
It was an experiment.
Yeah. I loved Cloverfield.
I thought Let Me In was fabulous. Now, I'm a big fan of the original
Let the Right One In.
Let the Right One In. But I thought his remake, he was brave enough to take on what is considered a masterpiece and make it something of his own. Mm. I think Matt Reeves is the director to watch. I think he is a director where he has gone from strength to strength to strength. He is working on the next sequel to
According to Internet Movie Database, that's his next film. Yeah.
So good for that. I have heard in the Unsubstantiated Rumors, which we'll come to later, I'll throw one in right now though. I have heard that they have been courting him for Star Wars.
Well, if Abrams is on Star Wars, so there's got to be,
Are we doing spoilers? For
I think we won't because it's so fresh, and I would like people to go out and enjoy this. I don't really want to throw
Go and see this. The other person we need to single out.
Can I just praise one more time, just Michael Giacchino?
Yes.
Michael Giacchino.
The soundtrack is fabulous.
Other than that, the other person who you don't get to see in the flesh on screen, of course, is Andy Serkis and all the motion caption performers who... Next level on this.
I think we can. I think we can honestly say
they've got their Oscar. Hey,
yeah.
Andy Serkis has actually formed his own company now, which I only found out about
the Imaginarium.
The Imaginarium,
Parnassus.
The Imaginarium is actually based in England, and it's a purely motion capture facility, and basically he is the god of motion capture. Let's face
it.
And in fact, I just read a really interesting tidbit of information the other day, which said that apparently Matt Reeves didn't like the performance in the last scene. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Really?
And it was actually the scene where, it's not spoiling anything, but there's a scene where he basically is standing in front of the crowd of apes.
Okay.
And it was
and he got a beautiful close-up.
It was beautiful, and it's the reaction. He wasn't happy. So he called Andy Serkis. This is how we have got to in cinema now. He called Andy Serkis and said, I'm not happy with the last shot. We need to do something about this. And because everything is an individual element, Andy Serkis went into his own motion capture studio and via Skype, Matt Reeves directed him in the motion capture studio, then piped the information back and they redid his performance for the last scene via remote control.
And you wouldn't know to watch it.
No, and you wouldn't know to watch it. And you sit there and you go, this is where we've got to. This has taken motion, or let's forget motion capture. This is a bad term because nowadays it literally is performance capture. This has taken performance capture to an all new level. This film would not pack the emotional punch that it did if they were just animated apes.
Certainly,
this packs the emotional punch because is Andy Serkis. That is Toby Kebbell. Yeah. That is a bunch of actors playing apes.
I don't know if you guys found this, but to me, they were almost imperceptible, subtle changes in their faces.
Yeah.
Subtle. Like,
nowadays, they are literally motion capturing everything on the face as well.
Yeah, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the whole... Who's responsible for it? Is it the animators or is it Serkis?
No, look,
just going to be like, they both did an amazing job.
I think the animators
Kerry Russell looked amazingly realistic.
the animators do an amazing job. Don't get me wrong. There's always going to be a collaboration with a performance capture film.
Yeah.
Kerry Russell was fabulous. Mm. It's so nice to see her on screen.
Can I just actually mention, we were talking about Jason Clarke before. He's John Connor in the next Terminator film.
Damn. So I think there's no argument that it is a collaboration to bring one of these characters to life, but the foundation of one of these characters is the actor behind it.
Totally, yeah.
And that actor's facial expressions, their mannerisms, their voice, their body movements, you can see Serkis much in this as you could in Gollum and as you could in King Kong.
Agreed.
He is the performance behind that. And what a performance. He's driving it. The other thing that is a technical achievement, because we all know in CG, fur is incredibly hard to do. The special effects people were actually talking. I saw another interview with them. They were saying that one of the biggest challenges to this film was most of it takes place in the rain, so they had to do fur.
They are insane. There's a lot of water sequences.
Yes,
there's a lot of high wind areas.
Yes,
there's a huge, huge, phenomenal fire sequence.
Yes,
where some of them get lit on fire. It's like they just said, let's do every element possible.
What are the hardest possible things to do in CG?
This has been too easy so far.
And I don't think there's a single shot in the movie where you go, it's not looking real.
At a
certain point, they look real.
It's like you believe that they're apes who are talking to each other and conversing. That's never a question. Even
Tim Burton's version
of Planet of the Apes, which we've all forgotten about, because I forgot that Marky Mark was in that. Like Mark Wahlberg, we mentioned, I forgot that he was even in that film. That's how memorable that film was. That was the peak of
makeup
and masks and so forth.
And that was great.
And that was phenomenal.
The makeup was fantastic.
But it was still clearly people in suits. Because they're basically standing upright. When Caesar stands upright, and you mentioned this before the show, Dave, when Caesar stands upright, it is a breathtaking moment because you realize, wow, they're actually, his whole body changes in a way.
And the anatomy is different.
Yes.
So it's not human, you know? Yeah. And so there's a definite feeling like this is an ape who is doing something
when he walks on two legs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? When he walks on two legs, it's kind of like this wow moment. It's almost as wow worthy as the no in the first movie.
Well, and this is why when Jason Clarke goes back to report what he's seen at the very beginning of the film, this isn't a spoiler.
It's like the first few minutes.
But he basically says, he was extraordinary.
Yeah.
You can see that he has been influenced by Caesar, who is he's so charismatic and so powerful a force on screen that you can see even the characters are overwhelmed by this presence, which no other ape has. It's because he was the original. He was the one who had the most of this stuff. Mm. He is the most human, to use the phrase,
it out was
of
the
all
most-
of them. Yeah. Human. All right, let's round this up. Out of five bananas, how many bananas?
Oh, you know what's funny on that? Really quickly, this film actually has a scene where an ape chucks a barrel and a human jumps over the barrel.
Really?
that actually happens in the movie. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Donkey Kong tribute, right?
We got to talk about that quickly, though. Like, they're riding horses,
riding,
and and they have machine guns. And this is Planet of the Apes. This is it. And the soundtrack is not like bom bom bom. You know, it's
no. Okay, so here's the question, because we started speculating this as soon as we finished watching the film. The third one, what are they going to call it?
Is it just going to be Planet of the Apes?
Is it just going to be Planet of the Apes? I think it's going to be called War of the Planet.
Because let's face it, Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes are basically the same title.
Sunset of the Planet of the Apes.
Mid-afternoon of Planet of
the waxing of the Planet of the Apes.
New Moon.
The New Moon. Yeah, Planet of the Apes. Yeah. New Moon.
What about Extinction of the Planet of the Apes or The Age of Ultron?
See, it's a real shame that the original 70s films have got it already. Because Conquest of the Planet of the Apes would fit perfectly here.
Yeah, what about, I don't know, they could just not even use it anymore.
POA. I think you've got a point. It could just be Planet of the Apes.
Poda. How many bananas?
Out of five bananas, how many bananas do you give
this? It's getting a full bunch of five from me.
And from
you? Yeah, same here.
Yeah,
I think
me
it's
too.
A
I think
magic
this is
our five. Trick.
This
yeah.
is one of the films of the year.
That's 15 bananas for a film on one show. Wow.
Speaking of food and films. Anyway, we saw something else. But before we get to that.
Oh, yeah.
Before we get to that, I just wanted to talk about a couple of the little things that we've watched throughout the week. I've got to say that I rewatched 2001 A Space Odyssey with my son. Who is very interested in seeing it. He's now at that age where he's starting to experiment in his film a little bit more, and he really wanted to see 2001.
I remember that age.
So we sat down and we watched 2001, and I understand his opinions, but it almost broke my heart. Because he loved the Discovery stuff, but he thought the first hour was boring.
To be fair, when I watched 2001 at his age, I felt the same way, and it was years later, and I think films like this, and I know this is a cop-out, but there are certain films that you need to have watched other films in the canon to kind of get an appreciation of what Kubrick was trying to do and what he did achieve with that.
And it's interesting because it did lead to an hour discussion after the film about why the film was so important and why it was influential.
Kubrick in particular were films I watched in my teens, were kind of like, okay, what's the fuss? Came back in my early 20s and was like, The Shining to me is now still one of the greatest horror films ever made.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, 2001, visually spectacular. There's so much going on in that.
And I got to say, I'm one of the people who actually not just thought it was boring or disliked it. I hated A Clockwork Orange the first time I saw it.
It took second viewing
when I finally got it.
Almost all of Kubrick's films, the second viewing for me. Yeah.
For me, I watched A Clockwork Orange. The anticipation and build-up for A Clockwork Orange had been... because I didn't see A Clockwork Orange until I was in my mid-20s.
Sure.
Yeah. And I finally got a screening. We went to the Valhalla Cinema in Melbourne. We went to a screening. I was so excited. I was finally going to see A Clockwork Orange. And I tell you, by the time we hit intermission, I was ready to leave. I was so disappointed because I had always equated Kubrick with perfection. Right?
Yeah, same here.
Everything is about perfectionism. Everything is about the absolute perfect shot, the this, the that. And I found A Clockwork Orange incredibly messy. It felt more like a Ken Russell film than a Kubrick film.
I
was sitting there going, what the hell has been the big hoo-ha about this film? This is a mess, and I hated it. It was actually going back, having a good discussion with friends of mine and so forth, and then going back and seeing it a second time with them was actually when I kind of went, get it.
Yeah.
You know? And it was that aha moment where I went, it's a satire.
It's funny how movies are like that when you... I was the same with Blue Velvet, actually. Mm. Watching it alone on, I guess, VHS at the time, I was kind of like, So this is David Lynch. This is what it's all about. Seeing it years later with an, and then I grew to love David Lynch through other films. Seeing Blue Velvet as part of a three Lynch film marathon. That's a marathon where your brain's bleeding out of your ears by the end of it. Because I think it was Blue Velvet, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive.
Oh my God, that the trifecta
back to back, which was an amazing viewing. But years later, watching Blue Velvet with an audience, you realize, that's actually really funny. That's funny. Mm. That's funny. Oh my God, that's what he's trying to do. Yeah. I get it.
And I had the same experience for a guy who was a Blues Brother who went to the Valhalla every Friday night, got up and danced, did all that stuff, and I've seen the Blues Brothers countless times. The first time I ever watched the Blues Brothers was alone on VHS tape, and I hated it. I thought it was the most stupid film I'd ever seen. It wasn't until experiencing it with an audience, I went, I want to come back to this.
If that's not an argument for getting off your asses
and going to the cinema,
and not download things illegally and bloody for cam films, for God's sake, you know. At least with cam films, you can hear a laugh track on it.
Go experience films the way they're meant to be experienced. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the thing. They are meant to be experienced with an audience in that.
We're called the Geek Movie Club, not the Geek Download Club.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yes.
Join us next week for GDC.
So 2001 was his first Kubrick film. We are going to continue with this, and hopefully he will find a stronger appreciation for Kubrick.
Actually, what I really enjoy, and it's something that our good friends at Hell is for Hyphenates, a podcast out of Melbourne, do, is watching an entire director's output in the order they were made.
So
you get a sense of how they progressed as a director. Now, this is something we're planning to do with Kevin Smith.
Yes.
Starting with,
and several others.
And several others, but one of the first ones we flagged, because we're all such big fans, is starting with May Day, the crumbling of a documentary, and going through from there all the way through to probably by the time we finish Tusk will be out. Which, have you guys seen the poster for that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's looking good. Trailer can't be too far away now, but you watch the trailer for Tusk?
No, it's Comic-Con is dumping it.
Yeah, but
will
you watch the trailer for Tusk?
I don't know. It's
a tough one, isn't it?
It's really hard. I'll wait and hear like how spoilery
but
it is.
You listen to Hollywood Babylon. Is there anything left in there he hasn't spoiled?
No, you know what? No, to be fair, I probably will watch the trailer for Tusk because of listening to that episode of Smodcast where they basically created the whole story. Yeah. So
also, but not only
I know
that,
the whole story.
Kevin
already.
Smith is an interesting filmmaker because
I knew about I knew the ending of Tusk.
Kevin Smith,
it was even a movie.
Kevin Smith is an interesting filmmaker because Kevin Smith, the making of the film is actually part of the film.
Yes. Mm.
So following how it's all progressed and put together and everything else, like Red State of the Nation and stuff like that, this is all part of the process.
It'd be really interesting. I'm really looking forward to going through this series again, seeing all of his films in order, because there are films like Chasing Amy, which is the one that I started to adore Smith with.
Yeah.
I haven't watched in years. I may not have watched that in 10 years.
I've just bought it on Blu-ray, actually.
Yeah, I've recently bought it on Blu-ray as well.
I just rewatched Red State again the other day. I bought that on Blu-ray, too.
And this will be me finally going and putting money down for and buying a copy of Red State on Blu-ray.
Because
I want to have them all on Blu-ray.
Of his films were on Blu-ray. I can't. Not all there.
Unfortunately,
Jersey Girl doesn't exist on Blu-ray.
Jersey Girl doesn't exist on Blu-ray. Clerks 2's gone out of print.
Dogma's not on Blu-ray here in Australia.
No.
Dogma, Jersey Girl, and actually, Mallrats as well, which is on Blu-ray.
No, Mallrats is on Blu-ray.
These are all I've got on DVD still, so I'm starting to finally replace them out. But Kevin Smith.
But thankfully, Cop Out's available on Blu-ray.
Cop Out with the best
commentary ever. Yeah,
ever.
It's amazing.
Even if you don't like the film, buy the Blu-ray.
It goes for like half an hour.
Twice as long as the film, and he keeps stopping the film.
And he's on screen the whole time.
Yeah, it's hysterical. It's one of the funniest things. The other thing that I got to watch this week. Finally, and I know I'm way late to this party, but I finally watched in 3D on my nice big TV, so I made sure I did it in the
Spring Breakers.
I watched I watched the film that I basically declared as homework and that I was not interested in seeing, which was Life of Pi.
Ah.
So I finally watched it.
I believe it's pronounced Life of Pi.
This is a film that...
Tell me what you thought Richard Parker.
This is a film that I have avoided
Slumdog Millionaire.
Sorry. This is a film that I have avoided like the plague because reviewers were saying things like...
You keep avoiding it, Richard Parker.
The most life-affirming film of the year and stuff like that. And I hate that sort of shit. And I got to a point where I went, this is pretentious wank and I have no interest in seeing this.
But it's a 3D film.
But I finally watched it in 3D and I watched it on the big screen in the middle of the night, nice and quiet, and I really got to focus on it.
Sorry, I just pictured you going, the whales, man.
I adored this film.
It is a wonderful film.
It is gorgeous to look at. I mean, it is just an amazing looking film. Technically amazing, because if you look at some of the behind the scenes stuff on how there is so much artificial shit in this film. I mean, he crapped it.
It's just rubbish. I hate that. Because the cinematographer won an award.
I know. I don't think he should have because most of it
even,
is...
Even no. The lead actor wasn't real.
Can I ask you guys something? Because you guys probably have...
And there was a great CG tiger. I mean...
Okay. The live action footage in the beginning, did you think it looked good?
No, it was actually...
See, he won an Oscar for really bad
once
work.
Once it got onto the water...
It's true. It didn't thank the animators. Yeah.
But I do say it does pack an emotional punch, and yes, it is a really lovely film. Is it the most life-affirming film I've ever seen? No.
Did Andy Serkis play the tiger?
He should have.
He was the boat, man.
No, it's an Ang Lee film.
He played the island in the middle, yeah.
It's an Ang Lee film. He probably paid the tiger. Yeah. Remember, he played the Hulk. When he did his Hulk film. Ang Lee likes to get in there. Ang Lee's still a wanker, don't get me wrong. All right, I think his films are still...
I believe it's pronounced Ang Lee.
Ang Lee. And I still think he's got a high wank factor.
I was revisiting some of his stuff this week.
Sense and sensibility, Dave.
I did this thing on the ABC about food and film, so I was revisiting stuff like Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Yeah. And which I remember when the Oscars that year, they read out Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Also, the phrase that Arnold Schwarzenegger uses when he's asking someone out for a date. I remember that so clearly.
So, look, bottom line, I did like it, and I'm glad I finally saw it. So, I'm going to get over that prejudice and say I've actually seen it.
Are you affirmed?
I'm not affirmed. No. I thought it was technically...
To be fair, I think we both can confirm he is alive.
I am alive. I thought it was an interesting experience that I would like to have seen at the cinema now. I wish I had gone to the cinema because it is beautiful.
Yeah, it was great in 3D.
Yeah, and the 3D works really well. My TV is, you know, great.
How many Richard Parkers would you give it?
I'd give it 4 out of 5. I'd give it 4 tigers out of 5.
Would you see a sequel?
No.
Dawn of the Life of
Life of Pi Square.
Life of Pi Square, exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Did you guys, before we move on to our little feature here that Dave's going to have to take his headphones off for, have you guys seen anything in the last 2 weeks since we've been
on? I'll very, very quickly
mention. I've been dominating this conversation. Yeah.
Can I quickly do this? Because I've been watching a fair chunk of Doctor Who.
What?
I'm up to, this is basically second wave of my marathon. I'm up to season 3 of Doctor Who, of New Who. So I'm well into Tennant now. And at the moment he's with Martha. And, but I'm also simultaneously watching Torchwood. Because the way you got to, and I've worked this great order list online. I think if you look up Iscariot Jones, Doctor Who running order, it's probably the best viewing order I've ever seen because it takes into account, you know, watching them in various clumps, watching, you know, so you watch a block of Torchwood together, then you watch a block of Doctor Who together. The idea is to finish Torchwood season 1 just before Utopia because that's when Captain Jack comes back into...
Right,
so I think the final episode of Torchwood season 1 is him running off and then he arrived after the TARDIS. And then he arrives back in time to go to Utopia and the whole Master storyline. And you can see there's a nice little balance going back and forth between the two of them. And I'm just about to introduce the Sarah Jane adventures into that as well. So I'll be watching 3 shows simultaneously.
Well, I've run into the same sort of roadblock as you because, we're doing the Buffy marathon.
Yes.
And I'm actually miles ahead of you at this point. Yeah. But that's okay because we're going to record it season by season. But I've just been plowing through it. And I've hit season 5. Now, season 4 was when Angel started.
Right.
Now... In season 4, there was a couple of crossovers.
Yes.
And so you kind of go, oh, now we got to kind of watch them concurrently because of crossovers. Season 5 is even worse than that. We have literally run into probably the greatest crossover of the Buffy, the entire Buffy show. And it's like, okay, Buffy stops now. We need to go back and catch up on Angel because suddenly we've reached this roadblock.
And Angel's a terrific show by itself.
And Angel is a great show, but... There's something about Buffy that is just inherently fun, where Angel doesn't have the same sense of fun. Mm. So you kind of keep going with Buffy, but we have to stop and go back to Angel now. So.
Can I just say, I've missed seeing David Tennant on screen. I just love it. And he looked, having only watched the 50th again so many times recently, watching him in the 3rd season, he looks so young.
Yes.
You know, he really, there was a lot of world weariness happening between when he left and came back after Matt Smith. But anyway... Martha's such an underrated companion. I don't know why she wasn't given.
And hot.
Yeah, and hot. I don't know why. When we look back, we always remember Billy Piper and, you know.
Yeah, Martha was great.
And Karen Gillan and so forth. But somehow Donna and Martha get overlooked. So don't, because they're both brilliant.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, that's pretty much what's been occupying me, apart from Oz Comic Con.
Dave?
I'll just talk quickly about one of my favorite shows from last year, just coming back for its second season, which is called Nathan For You. I don't know if you guys
have ever
heard of this show. It's brilliant. It's one of the funniest things on television. Basically, it's this comedian slash actor called Nathan Fielder. And it's a real life kind of mockumentary thing in the vein of Borat, like Bruno kind of thing. But, so the thing is that Nathan Fielder finds poor, like failing businesses in the LA area. And then what he does is he tries unorthodox techniques to make their business improve. So, for example, like the first episode back had a storyline where it was he puts a mechanic to a lie detector test. And so, you know, you check if you get your real value. This new episode back last week, what it's run was there was a failing clothing store in LA. So the idea was to make it look like a movie set as if it was filming to get all the tourists to come in and buy clothes while they were there. So what he did was he hired a celebrity impressionist to be Johnny Depp. And coax the fake extras to come in and buy stuff in the store. So what ended up happening was like they were led to, you know, pretend that they were in the scene with Johnny Depp behind the camera and put through sales on their credit cards. So the cameras are rolling, Johnny Depp's there, and they're like, "That'll be $80." And they're like, "Okay, so should I pay on my card?" He's like, "Yeah, keep going. You're really charging me." So that's the first half of the episode. Then it moves into him potentially being sued because there's no real movie. So what he has to do is then actually go out and create a movie, create a film festival. So it's a legitimate film.
I have to look this show up.
You have to watch it.
Definitely.
It's absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
All right, so
that's what
that
I've
is
been
one
watching.
To watch for us. We're gonna
and I saw our Transformers, Age of Extinction.
Hey, dog. I'm an inventor, all right? I think we got a Transformer.
We can't spoil it, can we?
Let's just skip to the chase.
Rocket shoes.
Rocket shoes. Goodbye, Dinobots. Best ending ever done in a movie.
I think if you go back last week, GMC 817, when we were underage, that's when I spoke about Transformers. You can hear my thoughts on it there.
What did you rate it out of five Dinobots? What are you giving it?
It was perfect. I don't know. I can't even give it a rating. It was crazy. I don't know.
Out of five,
I'll say
Mark Wahlberg
penises, I'll give it five alternating ratio shifts in IMAX. How's that? Every shot just changed.
And one problematic Blu-ray release.
Did you see an IMAX?
Yeah, I did.
Actually. Yeah, wasn't it strange? Because like he has IMAX shots that are like insert shots of people grabbing cups, and it goes from like your normal ratio to someone grabs a cup to. Back to you. It's like, why are those your
I thought
IMAX
we were
shots?
Past that era.
How many problematic Blu-ray releases out of five do you give that? Yeah. You know,
anyway, but we did also see one other
thing.
It was
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, it is. You so you're going to have to take your headphones off now, Dave.
You're going to have to take your headphones off, Dave. We also Richard and I got to go to the IMAX cinema, and we got to see 17 minutes of Guardians of the Galaxy, which was staggering. And what Richard and I decided to do, and this is probably going to be an ongoing feature of the show from now on, which is immediate reactions. We'll carry a recorder with us.
Immediate reactions.
We'll come up with a theme for it.
I'll come up with a theme.
But what we did was we just grabbed the recorder and we thought rather than try and remember it all now.
With Richard and Dave.
We would record right there outside the cinema while it was still fresh. And this is what our thoughts were on Guardians.
They call themselves the Guardians of the Galaxy.
What a bunch of a-holes.
Okay, so we have just walked out of a 17-minute preview of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Sorry, what film was that?
Richard, what are your first impressions?
Awesome!
So what we actually saw was the prison break scene, which was it introduced all the characters basically meeting each other, which by the looks of it is for the first time. And them getting in, and then Rocket, of course, having a plan to get them out. And the sequence was brilliant. I mean, it was just...
And all the elements were there from the beginning, you know. Groot's Groot, Rocket's got his personality right out of the bat.
Quill's the laconic, laid back, but surprisingly effective person. Gamora's kick ass.
The thing I didn't remember from the comic books, I don't think it's there, is the literal nature of Drax.
No, look, I don't. The funny thing is, Drax has never made a massive impression on me. I mean, he's just a muscle.
Yeah, he's just muscle.
So to hear him come to life was kind of a bit of a shock to the system, I think.
Yeah, and they made the character so that his race only speak literally. Every word means something. They don't believe in metaphors.
Yeah, for example, there was a line in there. It's like, you know, oh, it's a metaphor to go over your head. No, it would not go over my head. I would catch it.
My reflexes are too strong. I would catch it.
Yeah.
It was staggering. So I think the word here basically is that if you were a bit put off by the last scene in Thor, the Dark World, which you watched that and kind of went, what is that? This puts it to rest. This basically shows us that, no, it's not like that scene.
Yeah, I mean, look, visually it's spectacular. All of this was set in the one location. It was in the Kiln.
The Kiln,
which is the Supermax prison in space, basically. And that's, I mean, it's like a giant panopticon in space. It's this big tower in the center, which plays a big pivotal role in their escape plan, in Rocket's plan.
Yeah.
And look, I had a big goofy grin on my face the whole time. These were my guardians living and breathing on screen.
They've made small modifications, just like they've done with all of the cinematic universe, by saying that Gamora wasn't actually Thanos' daughter, but was the adopted daughter of Thanos, and she's actually genetically modified to be who she is. So little tweaks here and there.
Rocket doesn't have the implants on his back in the comic, does
he? No, because he's genetically created, whereas here they're looking like he's some sort of weird genetic...
Enhanced hybrid.
Yeah. But and I love that line because it's actually in the comic book as well, where he goes, "I'm not going to listen to a raccoon." He goes, "What's a raccoon?"
Yeah. And so, actually, well, on that, Rocket's voice, we have to hear the most of it for the first time.
And Bradley Cooper was not disappointed.
No, look, in my head, it's always been, you know, the British Cockney. Oh, I'm Rocket Raccoon. We want Rocket Ray, right?
Yeah.
But that's it, I think it would have stood out too much in the film, you know. So I think this fits in perfectly.
I think they've made some wise choices.
And Groot.
Groot is fabulous, and but tell you what, talk about a non-existent role for an actor to take with three words, basically. But he actually gives expression to everything that he does, and it's exactly as you would picture it in the comic book. He's fabulous. And I love the addition that he can just grow and shrink at will.
Yes.
He just kind of just plants out.
Yeah, and they climb up him.
He puts that shield up at one point with all the vines and thistles.
A lot of visual comedy with him, too. Like, they're doing a plan at the start. We won't spoil this bit for you, but they're planning out how to escape, and Groot does something in the background while they're all talking.
Yes.
And it's just great sort of secondary visual humor that James Gunn seems to be quite good at.
It's fantastic. Production design, they got the tone right. It just looks fantastic. I mean, all around, the characters look right. This is going to be the hit of the season. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, we've got what we had, 12% of a film?
About that.
Which is better than 11% of a film. If you've seen the new trailer, you know what we're talking about.
And that being said, they showed the new trailer, which is the extended trailer at the end in 3D on the IMAX screens, and oh my God, it just looks fantastic.
Brilliant. We were excited about this film anyway. I had a little bit of worry thinking if they get it wrong, you know, this could stuff up all those other experimental Marvel films that could come out. We may never get a Black Panther or a Namor or you know, an Inhumans film if this fails, particularly not Inhumans because it's the space stuff.
Absolutely,
fails, you know.
Yeah.
But if this works as well as it looks like it's going to work based on the 17 minutes and that new trailer, I think we're going to have Dave Longo, you may not have to eat your shoes.
You may not have to. I don't know. I still don't know if it's going to take as much money as the Avengers, but I think it is going to be a hit.
Yeah.
It was pointed out to us that one of the reasons why they're showing 17 minutes and extended trailers is they're trying to get people to get it.
Yeah.
Because, come on, it is a hard sell.
Yeah.
But I think...
But if they'd done that, they really should have just opened this. I mean, you know, this was competition only.
Yeah.
Winners here in Sydney. I don't know what it was like in the States when they showed this footage, but really, if they wanted people to get it, this footage should have been put online or something like that. It should have been more accessible. There is a new trailer out today, but...
And the trailer is quite long, too.
They are marketing this hard.
Yes.
So, look, you know, we've stood here talking into the fuzzy box long enough, I think.
I think we have, and let's go back to the studio.
And we sounded very excited about this film.
Yeah, God, we go on, don't we?
where were you guys when you were
right outside the IMAX?
IMAX, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. So,
the only thing I'm going to add to that is my one final comment on it is...
I am Groot.
There you go.
So that's all I've got to say.
suppose that looks like a show then.
I think that does look like a show. I think on that note, we may finish this show up. We will be back again next week for more of this nonsense. I'm sure, you know, this actually, now, this went a lot longer than I thought it would go.
Now, the music we're going out on this week, now you might recall a few episodes back, we went out on Iggy Azalea's Fancy, which is a great little catchy tune. I think there's been some controversy around her lately about whether she actually writes her songs or not. That's interesting. Whether she's the Milli Vanilli of rap. but somebody has covered her song on Conan O'Brien this week. Neil Young covered a version of Fancy, and he was joined not long afterwards during the song by Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Awesome.
To cover the song. So without any further ado.
No, don't play that yet. We've got a sign out.
Without any further ado, we're going to do the sign out, David.
Oh, I thought you were about to I thought he was about to start the music, didn't you?
For God's sake, I've been there on the show before.
Richard, where can people find more of you?
Oh, no, I don't press the button. I should just play the music despite you. You can find me on Twitter at DVDBits. You can find me online at TheRealBits.com or behindthepanels.net.
I'm Mark Wahlberg, and you can find me at Gear.
You can find me at your mom, okay?
You can find me at demcup.com or wherever on the internet.
You just crack yourself up, don't you?
Where can we find you, David?
You can find me. You can find me on Twitter at David.
This show is not going to be released.
Or the show, of course, is part of the GeekActually.com podcast, which you can find at GeekActually.com, which is going to be celebrating its 500th episode soon, which is kind of exciting.
500, ridiculous.
And 6 years of podcasting.
How many hours, Dave? You know?
God, I did have that figure in front of me, but I don't think I've got it in front of me.
Six
right
million.
Now. We'll talk anyway, about it more next week when we get a bit closer. But our anniversary is coming up. I'm going to bring this club to order and say,
it's easier on the knuckles, too.
Yeah, it is.
The hammers.
Order! And Richard, take us out.
I'm so fancy. You already know I'm in the fast lane from LA to Tokyo. I'm so fancy. Can't you taste this gold? Remember my name about to blow. I'm so fancy. You already know I'm in the fast lane. LA to Tokyo, I'm so fancy. Can't you taste this gold? Remember.